Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A science story, huh?
He's NYU scientist.
I felt right.
I was so
and I just
happy.
Thought, well,
I had figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben Lilly, and welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. This week's story is from George Church. It was recorded in July 2015 at Oberon in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
So, I'm all about risk. It's a very ancient and I think deeply human urge to want to harness nature, whether it's fire or living creatures. And that's what I'll tell you about. My father was an Air Force pilot. He would fly the strata tankers that would be full of fuel that they would inject by mating with a B-52 bomber. I think the hypothesis is this was keeping America safe. And the B-52, of course, had the ultimate fire in it, which was hydrogen bombs. And they never dropped it on our enemies, but they did drop two of them on North Carolina at one point when one of these mating procedures didn't quite work out. So my father had harnessed fire and air, while my uncle Johnny was conquering the animals of earth and water. Family legend had it that Johnny, when he was pre-teenager, he would disappear for days at a time, and he would sew his Native American name into his foot. This was his imaginary name. And would come back with live snakes, plural, in his bare hands to sell to the people that made the anti-venom for people who accidentally got bit by snakes. So when he grew up, naturally, he became a wrangler of sea creatures. And one day he asked me to go across this little 4-inch wide plank that went across. He said, go fetch me the pail on the other side of the pond, this wooden plank without any railings. And I thought, hey, that sounds like fun. I just went run across it. My hypothesis was that I could trust my Uncle John. About halfway across, I see that underneath me is like this swirling mass of muscle of sharks and really ugly hammerheads and stuff. But I ran across, I got the pail, I went back, and I said, this is a pretty cool job he's got. I could do this. So I grew up wild, kind of like my uncle, into earth and water of all sorts. And this wasn't like your pristine white beaches. This was smelly mud was what I loved. And it was in my backyard, the smelly mud. I would go out and fetch blue crabs and mullet from this mud, and family would eat them. There was an albino dolphin that we caught, or the fishermen brought in one day, and we'd keep it wet until they could take it to the local show. And one of the hypotheses I learned that, you know, when I was swimming in one of the ponds and I saw bubbles coming towards me really fast, the hypothesis that they were bubbles coming toward me really fast was probably incorrect, and I should get out of the water because they were. Alligator eyes, so I'd get out of the water, and I would scoop up a little little of the water, and in it one day was this really ferocious-looking water bug. I mean, it turned out it was a predatory water bug, and I kept it in a little jar. And the next day, I looked in there, and it was gone. And I thought, gee, I'm such a cruel, I didn't feed it the right thing, and I didn't feed it enough, and it was just disintegrated. There were just little bits of it left. And I was just blaming myself. And then I looked inside, and I looked around, and there was a dragonfly in there, sitting up on the top, hiding away from me. And I said, that dragonfly ate my bug. That was my hypothesis. But I wasn't really sure. I couldn't figure out how the dragonfly got into the sealed jar. That was the weak point of my hypothesis. Nobody in my family was a scientist, and so I had to figure this out myself. And I was mildly dyslexic, so I would focus on the science books that had a lot of pictures. And I figured it out, and when I figured it out, it was a big thrill. And I said, "Boy, I could do this for the rest of my life, you know. I could do this." And so I was also in charge of taking care of the yard. We had about an acre of land, and it was... let's say that the neighbor's yard on either side would look like a golf course. It was beautiful, green Florida grass, and you could putt on it. And ours was like 30% dirt and 70% this plant called sandspurs. And I don't know, every year, you know, sandspurs. But for those of you who haven't seen them, you really have to imagine the most devious, sharp, tenacious seeds that would stick onto you like magnet, and it would hurt. And so I was paid a penny a plant. These are these sprawling plants covered with sandspur seeds, penny a plant to pull them out of the yard. And I was also supposed to clear the woods that we had that separated our lawn from the mud that was the bay. And I would go in there with this double-edged axe. That was my toy, and I would clear it out. But the process of getting rid of the sandspurs and the underbrush from the woods was hopeless in Florida, where things would grow so fast. By the time I got kind of halfway through, the first half was already grown back. And one day, my best friend Wayne was over, and we thought we would use advanced physics, optics, that is, and we would harness the Florida sun, and we would kill the sandspurs and other living things by focusing this magnifying glass onto the sandspurs. And this death ray really worked like a charm. The thing would burst in flames, and then we'd stamp it out, and then we'd move on to the next sandspur. We did this. You know, we had just inexhaustible energy, and not the sun, but us. And and then Wayne had to go home, and I'm sitting in the kitchen, and a couple hours later, a neighbor comes over and knocks on the door, and I'm the only one home, so I open the door, and he says, "I'm really glad that you guys are finally taking care of that awful-looking woods that you had in the back." And I say, "Yep." And he starts to walk back to his house, and he says, "Ah, it's a nice fire you got." And I say, I try to look real calm. I wait until he goes away. And so I go out and I look, and sure enough, there's the entire woods is on fire. Flames going up 10 feet or more. And we had so carefully put out all these fires that we had started with the sun. And so at this point, my confidence in fire, in my knowledge of fire, is diminished. But I still have one, secret weapon, which is the element of water. So I have a great deal of experience with hoses and garden hose technology. And so I go... And, in the movies, they sometimes wonder, why is it they never dial 911? They come up with some really complicated plot twist for why they can't do it. And my plot twist was that I didn't really like talking to adults that much. And especially if they were likely to put me in jail for arson or something like that. And so, and besides, I was super busy putting out a fire. So I put out the fire, and the you know, lessons were learned of sorts. And you know, and I've reflected since then, since I'm all about risk and safety and so forth these days, about how it is that humans keep getting more and more sophisticated about dealing with really very, very risky things, and kind of convincing themselves they can take the next step forward, you know, like dropping hydrogen bombs on North Carolina. And so in this tradition, that's kind of what I do for a living, is I look at nature with greater respect, greater and greater respect, and, you know, fear, but not quite paralyzing fear. Yeah, so thank you.
That was George Church. George is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, director of the NIH Center for Excellence in Genomic Studies, and director of personalgenomes.org, which provides the world's only open-access information on human genomic, environmental, and trait data. His 1984 Harvard PhD included the first methods for direct genome sequencing, molecular multiplexing, and barcoding. His innovations have contributed to nearly all next-generation genome sequencing methods and companies. He has also pioneered new privacy, biosafety, environmental, and biosecurity policies. His honors include election to NAS, NAE, and Franklin Bauer Laureate for Achievement in Science. He has co-authored 370 papers, 60 patents, and one book. The Story Collider is produced by me, Brian Wecht, Aaron Barker, Ari Daniel, Christine Gentry, Skylar Bear, and Liz Neely. The podcast is produced by Rose Eveleth. Additional help from Brooke Williams, Lena Groger, and Justin D'Ambrosio. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to Oberon for hosting the show, and to the forest by my house for never teaching me a lesson. Thanks for listening.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.